Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello, welcome to this edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and if you're listening, expecting to hear the North American tones of Jim Hart, I'm afraid he's been called away on business, leading a very big project at work. But rest assured, he is going to return. In the meantime, the Football Times contributors, we're all going to take up the reins. So, this edition, we are talking all things Premier League in the lead up to next weekend's opening round of fixtures. And I couldn't have asked for three finer people to join me tonight, all are regulars on the Lob and all are senior writers for These Football Times. And all of them support teams who are going to hopefully be challenging for the Premier League come May. So first of all, we have Arsenal fan, Mr. Chris Weir. Hi, Chris. You all right?
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Yeah, no problem. We have Liverpool fan, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you?
Oh, very well, thanks, Stuart. How's it going your end?
Yeah, great, although it is roasting, believe it or not. It is absolutely boiling in Hull.
Same here. It's tropical. Absolutely tropical.
And then now, from somewhere between England and Spain, but we've not been able to pin him down for the last 2 or 3 weeks, we have Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you?
I'm good, Stu. Thanks, mate. I'm in England for 2 more days, mate. We're off to Spain on Wednesday, but I'm great, thanks. And much of your confidence in Chelsea's performance being challenging for the league this season, I probably don't share that very much, especially on today's game. Which is great to be with you guys.
Don't worry. We'll get to today's game. Don't worry about that. We won't spend long on it, don't worry. We also have some listener questions that we're going to discuss throughout the Lob as well. So, like Gary mentioned, there's no better place to start than the traditional English football season curtain raiser, the Charity Shield, which took place this afternoon. So, Gary, unfortunately, do you want to kick us off with your thoughts from today's game?
Yeah, I guess it was probably a typical pre-season not friendly, almost friendly game. Both teams denuded of star players. Both teams looked to play a pressing game in heat that didn't really allow that sort of game. Not a great advert for the game. I think City won comfortably. They could have won by more than needed to, but they were by far the better team. And I guess, you know, from a Chelsea point of view, if I'm looking positive, it's probably the worst game you're going to have all season, Man City, because not only they're champions, but they're probably stonewall favourites to win the championship this year as well.
Yeah, Stephen, anything to add?
Yeah, I think Jim's nailed it there. I've not seen the game as yet. I've had an afternoon out with the kids in the sunshine. Just kept an eye on the updates via the BBC Sport website. I don't think there's any surprises that I'm expecting to see when I come to watch it. I think Gary's doing Chelsea a bit of a disservice there in what he'd expect from the season. I can understand a bit of foreboding, but it's a new project starting. And on the counter scale, you know, we had that first season of acclimatisation before winning the league. Chelsea will come on strong again. And I think we're heading into an interesting season where anything can happen. Which we'll come to as we discuss it, but I still expect great things from Chelsea this season.
Chris, I'm an Arsenal fan. Am I right in thinking your first two games are Manchester City and Chelsea?
It is, yeah, and you can probably tell how confident I am about getting the result.
that's a baptism of fire for the new manager, isn't it?
Absolutely, but he can't be any worse than Monsieur Wenger has done in the past few years against those same teams. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but you know, Arsenal fans have been hurt before and you know, we probably will be hurt again. So I'm reserving judgment for now. But the game today was an interesting one, actually. I don't think Chelsea fans will be too downhearted, simply because the likes of Eden Hazard and N'Golo Kante were missing. And there's more than enough to suggest that this will be a positive season. You know, Jorginho is a fabulous addition. Callum Hudson-Odoi is a tremendous talent. on the wing. He's been really impressive in pre-season. Looks ready for the step up to the first team. And from Manchester City's perspective, I thought Phil Foden was exceptional today. Probably Manchester City's best player. And Bernardo Silva in the centre in the Kevin De Bruyne position didn't do himself any misdeeds. So encouraging signs for City. They don't look like they're ready to relinquish their grip on the domestic scene anytime soon. But I don't think Chelsea fans have reason to be too downcast about today.
In fairness, I'm happy to agree with most of what Chris says there. I thought Hudson-Odoi looks a real prospect. And yes, obviously with players missing Hazard and N'Golo Kanté, Giroud, Thibaut Courtois obviously wasn't in goal as well. So a lot of players missing. So I mean, I'm not too downhearted about Chelsea's prospects. And as I say, that's the toughest game you're going to get. Man City is probably the toughest game you're going to get all season. And I just like to think that this season, we've got a manager who's going to give these younger players a chance. I'd like to see Hudson-Odoi get a run in the team. And obviously, you know, the players who've been out on loan, you know, we've got players who are playing for England who we put out on loan. These guys need to be playing first-team football, and I hope Sam is the guy who's going to give them a chance.
It's, yeah, I watched most of the second half. I thought Foden was outstanding. I thought he had a really, really good game. You just wonder, I suppose, how much trust Guardiola will have in him. I suppose it's a learning process for him, but, you know, for a young lad, how, you know, is he going to play in the big games, or is it going to be more of the same League Cup action, you know, those sorts of things for Foden. But while we're on the subject of the Charity Shield, I just wanted to ask you guys, it always used to be taken quite seriously. It was like we said, a curtain raiser. Mourinho, a couple of years ago, included it when he talked about winning the treble, including the Europa League and the League Cup and the Charity Shield. But I suppose, Stephen, is the Charity Shield what it once used to be?
I don't think it is now. I mean, it can be, like it's been said, in retrospect, you can look back and say, yes, it was a confidence booster in certain respects. But I think it's a cyclical thing, and that's not just time. That's just the way that teams evolve. And it can be massively important, you know, as a confidence booster, as a springboard. You know, it can also be a detrimental thing. I mean, it can go back to kind of like Newcastle being taken apart by Manchester United in the wake of them blowing that title in 96. And that had Keegan was gone, you know, within it was by the December. So it can have a, you know, an influence on how a team will play, but sometimes it can be the opposite way around. It's not necessarily the team that wins it. Sometimes it's the team that loses it. From a Liverpool perspective, when we were in most years, you know, we had years where we'd lose it, but it had no burden on the rest of the season. I think the one time I can remember it having some kind of burden was we lost to Everton at the start of 84-85, and we did have a bad start to 84-85. But I can remember losing it to Man United, and it made no difference. We won the treble, and so it just depends. You know, it's an atmospheric thing. But some years it can mean absolutely nothing to how a team does. Other years it can. Actually, this year I don't expect it to make much of a difference, because I think Manchester City will have a more difficult season than many expect this time around. So, you know, it'd be interesting that City winning it could kind of engender a false sense of security in a way. Is that Manchester City have never, ever, in whatever guise throughout history, retained a league title. And, you know, even now within this period of domination, really, and the blessed with the money that they've got, if that's what you want to call it, you know, so Mancini wins the title, but he doesn't retain it. Pellegrino wins the title and he doesn't retain it. So Guardiola has to do something different for Manchester City now, is that he has to make it a dynasty. It's not just, you know, a short project and then suddenly it's going to have to be someone else because they didn't go on. There'll be big things expected of Manchester City because they've run away with it last season. Everyone would expect Manchester City to win it again, but they are going into new ground because they've never retained a league title. Plus, as the Champions League, they will be expected to win the Champions League at some point. And the longer that takes, the more time that passes with them not winning it, the more pressure will be applied upon them. So there will be a point this season where, you know, questions will be asked, and it's how they respond to that. They're still a majestic football team. You have to expect them to win everything. They can't win everything. It will be with added pressure this season, and that's one of the things that makes this season very interesting, is that Manchester City will have to start doing things that they've never done before to go on and go forth.
Yeah, I mean, like we've mentioned it before, Chris, haven't we, that obviously, you know, Arsenal's first two games. How much stock do you, as a fan, or, you know, if you think of the managers and players' perspective, how much stock do you think is taken from pre-season friendlies or pre-season performances?
I think Arsenal's situation is quite unique in that everyone's looking towards the club to see what's being done differently, how the players are performing, indeed what players are being picked. I think Unai Emery has tried to answer those questions with the way that he set his team up to play, and the formations and the style of the play. And I seen Arsenal in Dublin on Wednesday, and it was fascinating to see the differences between how his team lined up in comparison with Wenger's. First, it was a recognisable system and structure of play. I thought Matteo Guendouzi, the young Frenchman, signed this summer from Lorient for $8 million, was excellent. And I actually think he should start the season because he looks like a tremendous talent in the midfield. I think Emery has gone about things the right way so far. He's addressed the areas of the squad that needed to be addressed, the weaknesses of goalkeeper, centre midfield and right back. You know, we have Bernd Leno, one of the best goalkeepers in the Bundesliga, in his mid-20s, capable, experienced, but with a good solid 10 years ahead of him. We have Stefan Lichtsteiner, you know, one of the most consistent, reliable right backs in Europe, to replace the ineffectual Hector Bellerin, who was incidentally absolutely dreadful again on Wednesday against Callum Hudson-Odoi. He was torn apart. And centre midfield, of course, Lucas Torreira, who impressed so thoroughly at the World Cup. So the signings and the way the signings have been made has been, you know, very impressive, particularly in the light of how Arsenal's transfer dealings were done even 10 years ago. You know, Arsenal fans still have in their memory the trolley dash last minute for the likes of Andre Santos and Mikel Arteta. So the early signs are promising. This new triumvirate under Ivan Gazidis, Sven Mislintat, Raul Sanyehi, and indeed head coach Unai Emery. So it's encouraging early signs, but the proof will be in the results. It's a difficult start. But everything in pre-season so far points in the positive. And one thing I did note, there was an article, I think, by David Hittner in The Guardian, and he makes the note that the team have been training intensely on things like team shape, training on things like positioning without the ball, all things that, you know, the club didn't really do under Arsene Wenger. I mean, the thing about Arsenal's weaknesses is they have been glaring and they have been obvious for years, so in a sense it can only get better, but you know, we'll see in a few weeks' time whether those positive changes translate into results, but so far so good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Chelsea and Arsenal are starting the season with, you know, with brand new managers who are new to the Premier League. Steven sat there quite pretty with Jurgen Klopp, who's, I think, in his third season now, Steven, he's in.
Do you know what? He just seems like he's been there for so long. I've actually lost count. Would he be going into his? I think this will be his third full season now.
He came part way through.
2015. Yeah, 16. It was 15, 16. He came, so 16, 17. Yeah, this is the start of what, you know, providing he finishes his third full season. Well, that's it. Football, you just never know, do you?
No.
Yeah, he's starting his third season as such. But yeah, we're looking the best we've looked for a long, long time. But within that, a lot of hard work to do to come anywhere near winning that title. Like mentioned, Manchester City have to be, you know, the team to beat. And for me, it's anyone's guess. I'm happy with the way we're playing football. I'm happy with the team we've got, the players we've got, and it is a case of putting all of those components together and getting an end result. Liverpool have had a generational habit now of either starting slowly or starting well and having a bad autumn, or getting to Christmas and being within the mix of things but falling away in January, there is always a dip somewhere along the way for Liverpool that they struggle to get out of, that they struggle to shake off. And they'll have somewhere, or well, we have had, and that's what we'll have to not have, is that 4 to 6 week span where we don't pick up a win. And that is what's blighted Liverpool, you know, manager after manager, season after season. So when these spikes have come up of a Liverpool side that's been there to challenge, it is that concept of just not having that, you know, taking your eye off the ball. And it's whether they can do that. It's all to do with the mentality and the concentration and the will to win. There are a lot of things involved in winning a league title. And you have to pull a lot together to do it. It's not just about having the money for it. Hence, Leicester managed to do it a couple of seasons ago. You look at Atletico Madrid in Spain. You know, it's a rarity, but it can be done. And it's all to do with bringing together a certain number of ingredients, and you've got to be perfect. You've got to, you know, no faults with you, the way that you go forward. And that's the test for Liverpool. It's not that they've not got the talent. It's not that they've not got the players to do so. It's certainly not that they've not got the manager to do it. It's just not fluffing your lines. And that's where Liverpool have got to now.
So Gary, obviously, out of everybody who's... I mean, I'm a Hull City fan, so I never need to worry about dipping in a Premier League season, whether it's going to cost us the title. That I never need to worry about that. So I'll leave that trauma with you fellas. But for you, Gary, obviously, your team are the last ones out of us guys to sort of, you know, to win a Premier League title. How do you think, obviously, taking today's game aside, how do you think Chelsea are shaping up, and what is a realistic target for Chelsea this season?
I guess a realistic target would be a top four. I hear what Steve says, but I don't think anybody's going to come close to Man City this season. If anybody does come close to Man City, I think it will be Liverpool. I think Liverpool have bought exceptionally well. Not only well, but they bought early as well. And they've addressed the one major glaring weakness they had, and they've brought an outstanding goalkeeper. For Chelsea, a lot depends on what happens in the next few days. You know, they say a week's a long time in politics. It's a week's probably an awful lot longer in football. By the end of by Thursday, we could have lost Hazard and Courtois and even Kante. If all three go, Europa League would probably be a reasonable aspiration. If we keep all three, I think, you know, Champions League is probably well within our grasp. It's such a difficult thing now with players. The problem we have in this country now with the crazy situation with the transfer window is that Premier League clubs can't buy anybody after Thursday, but they can sell players up until the end of August. So that could put a lot of a difficult situation. One major signing, Rob Green, one captain's major signing in the transfer market this summer. That's Jorginho. Looks like an outstanding talent. However, if Chelsea got aspirations to compete seriously for a Champions League, let alone the title, then they've got to either A, make sure you retain at least Hazard and Kante. I think that's essential. If Courtois wants to go, you know, use the money to buy another goalkeeper. But if we lose all three of those and we don't replace them with anything like similar quality of players, Champions League is probably going to be a distant horizon, I think. There's so many clubs now who are going to be improving. Tottenham, Man United are going to be there or thereabouts, Man City, Liverpool, even Arsenal under Emery. You know, who knows how that's going to pan out. So for Chelsea, I think it's going to be, let's say, an interesting season. It could go one way, it could go the other way. One thing's for sure with Chelsea, it ain't going to be boring, that's for sure.
It's funny you mentioned that, actually. I was, of all the clubs, I think Chelsea are the ones, like you mentioned, Gary, I think they're the ones who are going to worry the most between the start of the season and the end of August, because you're right, you know, players... Deals done between, you know, English clubs can't happen, but certainly players looking to go abroad and, you know, Real Madrid, Barcelona, sorry, have spent quite big recently. Real Madrid will probably be looking to spend again before the end of the before the end of the transfer window. And if I was a Chelsea fan, you know, I think I would be worried about those sort of 2 or 3 weeks leading up to it, because, you know, how do you go about replacing Hazard if he leaves post close of the transfer window?
I think the simple answer, Stu, is you can't. There's no way you're going to get a player of that calibre. I don't know how much crazy money he's going to be talking, 160, 180, 200 million. I mean, who knows? Apparently there was talk in the paper today that they're going to offer him a contract worth £300,000 a week. I mean, OK. I don't know if he can replace that sort of talent. I think, strangely enough, though Hazard is an iconic player for Chelsea, the biggest loss would be Kante. If looking at the game today, the hole was in the middle of the midfield. You know, they used to say when Kante was playing with Fabregas, Kante plays on the right, Fabregas plays in the middle, and Kante plays on the left. That's how important he is. You know, he's such an excellent player. He proved it in the World Cup. He made Pogba. He created an opportunity for Pogba to display the talents that Mourinho stifled for a season. For some crazy reason, he's under a blanket. But Kante is an outstanding player, and if we lose him, that's a crisis. If we lose Hazard, you know, that's a real problem. But Kante is a crisis if we lose him. But we can't replace players of that calibre in a few days. And unless they know these guys are going to go, or one of these guys are going to go, and there are plans in place to replace them with somebody of the same similar sort of ability, then it's going to be a sort of a marking time season for us, inevitably.
Look, obviously we've talked a lot about replacing players. Chris, obviously we've talked a lot about Arsenal, Liverpool and Chelsea, but looking beyond those three, you know, is there anybody else who you think has spent well?
One side jumps out immediately, and that's Fulham, who've made some incredible acquisitions so far. Jean-Michel Seri, this time last year, was being linked with Barcelona. In fact, came within a day of joining Barcelona. And one of the finest passing midfielders in Europe. So that is a phenomenal signing there. André Schürrle, World Cup winner, former Chelsea and Borussia Dortmund star. Arguably not played great in the past 18 months, 2 years, but still phenomenal player on form. They, of course, have Ryan Sessegnon, who scored 15 goals last year. And he'll be putting in the crosses this year for Alexander Mitrovic, who's joined on a substantive deal. And he's discovered his best form in West London. And then you get to the defence. Alfie Mawson, one of the standout defenders in the league last year in a team that was relegated. And Fabry, the Besiktas goalkeeper. Fulham's transfer business has been phenomenal so far, I have to say. But they're not the only ones who've made shrewd acquisitions. You have Everton. Now, if you'd asked me a couple of days ago, I would have told you that Everton's transfer business thus far has been a bit wishy-washy and indulgent. I don't think Richarlison is a 40 million player. I think he's mostly hype and not a lot of ability. But the signing of Luca Dean is fantastic at left-back. Was unlucky not to feature more for Barcelona and PSG. And I don't know whether it's confirmed yet, but Yerry Mina, another Barcelona player, he had a tremendous World Cup for Colombia. So a couple of decent signings at Goodison Park there. Crystal Palace, another one. Max Meyer, one of the best midfielders in the Bundesliga. And Brighton, Alireza Yavambash, the Iranian, a winger come forward, top scorer in the Eredivisie last year. Tremendous talent, had a quiet World Cup, didn't really do too much. But Leon Balogun, the Nigerian centre-back, he was also decent. So a lot of teams have made some, you know, top-tier acquisitions this summer. Unfortunately, other teams haven't been quite as active in the transfer market. Tottenham being the prime example of that. With every day that passes without a signing, the groans from Spurs fans get ever louder. They need badly to make reinforcements to a squad that just at the minute looks paper thin. Particularly as with it looks like Moussa Dembélé not featuring this year, there's still no replacement for Harry Kane should he get injured or lose form. So they really need to conclude some deals there. Manchester United, Jose Mourinho has made his feelings eminently clear thus far about the lack of activity at Old Trafford. You know, Fergie is a fantastic midfielder, capable of playing in any position across the midfield, but he can't do it all by himself. And Diego Dalot, the Portuguese right-back, is injured. So, you know, there's a reason why Mourinho was so frustrated, shall we say, with Ed Woodward and the lack of the activity there. But by and large, the Premier League, most of the Saints have done some shrewd business thus far, but Fulham are the club that jumps out at me specifically.
Yeah, I agree exactly. I mean, Fulham, I think Fulham have been outstanding with their business. I think they've gone about it very well. They've been quick, they've been decisive, you know, and they've added quality to their side. Obviously, you know, Stephen and Gary, you know, we've chatted on, you know, on some of the World Cup podcasts, certainly on the later ones, about how difficult in a World Cup summer or a major championship summer, how difficult it is to sort of do your business, get your squad together. You know, what's your take, Stephen, on how, I suppose, how clubs go about doing their business when we've had such a late finish to a major tournament?
I think teams allowed a lot more flexibility now. I think once upon a time, once players were handed over to World Cup squads, they'd be cut off from society. Whereas to me, it just seems now that players are, you know, able to negotiate transfers virtually all the way up to the start of a major tournament. You know, they'll pull up the drawbridge 24, 48 hours before the tournament starts. And then, obviously, by the time that teams start to tip out, as soon as they're out of the tournament, then they're back into negotiations. You know, they have entourage. It's not just about a player now with an agent. They have, you know, a whole team behind them. So, you know, that will negotiate on their behalf. So, you know, for me, I think it's not the way it used to be. I'm not saying that's a bad thing or anything, but I do think a lot of transfers are agreed, at least in principle, long before tournaments come into view now. Liverpool's business has been immaculate this summer, and there's still talk and rumours of certain players that are currently being negotiated for next summer. And that seems to be a way now that clubs are combating things like this, the shortened transfer window. And again, it's not a bad thing, is that planning for the future aspect, as it's been mentioned with Fulham. Fulham have been fantastic, but there are other instances where they've just been slow. Manchester United have been frustrated. It's almost been like a summer where it was like when David Moyes got the job and he couldn't buy a player. And, you know, he was gone before the next summer. And it is, it's a strange one. You either hit the floor running, you are organised and prepared, or you're not. And it might not necessarily be a case of not being prepared. It's just that if you've got three transfers lined up, you're negotiating for them, everything looks right, and then at the last minute, you know, the change of heart, you know, move in a different direction or stay with a club that was meant to be selling. You know, and there's a lot of variables, you know, within that. And yeah, definitely doing your business early has worked. You know, it's a big tick for me with Liverpool. And yeah, the longer you were drawn into that summer, the closer you were drawn to that deadline day, the more you were held to ransom.
We've chatted a lot, you know, about the Charity Shield and the build-up to the season. I'm going to throw at you a couple of listener questions. Now, we've sort of got two questions from two different listeners, but I'm going to lump it together as one topic for discussion. So get ready, Gary, because I'm going to throw it your way first, OK?
Thank you, brother.
No worries. So, bear with me. So the first sort of the first request really is from Matias at Gospod_Professor, and he essentially would just like us to discuss the influence of managers in the Premier League. But before you answer that, there's another question from Mark Neil at Mark_Neil70, and his question is: Pep, Sarri, Klopp, Pochettino, Emery, Mourinho. Is the Premier League the best league in the world for coaches?
Wow. Okay. Well. Okay. So let's sort of try and pick those apart. So about the influence of managers in the league. I think that's a massive thing. That's why Premiership managers who take control of teams in the Premiership can command such massive control of clubs and an ability to buy players that they want because they can deliver. I think the second part is a really interesting one, and I'd almost like to break that up a little bit if I can. Guardiola, Sarri, Klopp, Pochettino, Emery, I almost think they're the new generation, and Mourinho almost seems to be, I won't say yesterday's news, but he's almost like a guy who's running to catch up where he was the leader of the pack a while ago. As soon as Ferguson went, he was the man. And it seems now, especially with Guardiola and Klopp and Pochettino, they're these young, thrusty managers who seem to be sort of taking over the mantle that he once held with a different way of playing. And it's almost like, the East Football Times magazine on philosophies and managers, how they apply them to different teams, is relevant here because they have a way of playing. And they're not dissimilar. And in Sarri, watching the game today, I think I mentioned earlier that there were two teams who want to press high and defend in the opponent's half of the pitch. And this is very similar to what Pochettino's got Tottenham doing. It's hard work, but you know, if you can make that transition to gain position in the team's half of the field, it's such an advantage. And this has been one of the key things that Klopp's done so successfully with Liverpool. And he's got that front three who are not only extremely talented players, but they work their damn socks off to pressurise defenders when they have possession, trying to build from the back. So, to go with a summary of the answers, the influence of managers in the Premier League is massive. It's influencing English football and the development of English football massively. And yes, I think probably for development and innovation, I think the Premier League might well be blessed with some of the best managers in the world.
Well done, Gary, you say that, and that's why I threw it out to you first.
No worries.
Chris, you've had a bit longer to think about it. What are your thoughts on the quality in general of managers? I mean, in my opinion, Gary's hit the nail on the head in between the new breed and the old style. I mean, we have Neil Warnock coming back into the Premier League this season, and it's not. I will not air my opinions via this podcast. So, same question to you, Chris. You know, what are your thoughts on the quality of management in the Premier League?
It's an interesting question. Undoubtedly, it's the best league in the world in terms of the quality of managers on display. But, you know, if you dig a bit deeper into that question, where did those managers develop and hone their skills? None of them, with the exception of Pochettino, actually developed in the Premier League. You know, it was the likes of La Liga, Serie A, where these managers really cut their cloth. And that's because in those leagues, you know, there's less short-termism, there's more trust, there's arguably less pressure, there's more room to put your stamp on a team, inculcate your ethos. And so whilst the Premier League does have the highest quality of managers, you know, it arguably has one of the lowest investments, if we can term it that way, into their coaching staff. I mean, you know, none of us can sit here and say that there isn't any such thing as a talented young English manager. We have the likes of Graham Potter, for example, one of the brightest young English managers, couldn't get a job in England, had to go to Europe. And that's just typical of the short-term sort of headline-driven cycle of management in the English game. So I don't think the Premier League has anything to be proud of when it comes to that. I think the Premier League is where the money is. You know, it's where the profile is, and that's why the best managers are here. Similarly to when Serie A was the biggest thing in town and all the best managers in Europe were in that league. It's the Premier League's day. It is the biggest league in the world, but I don't think it has anything to be especially proud of when it comes to developing young managerial talent, with the exception, arguably, of Pochettino. But again, at Espanyol, he really made his reputation there. You know, if he was an English coach, would he have been given a similar opportunity at a club of Espanyol's stature? I'm not too sure. I don't think he would have. So that's, in the longer term, something that might need to be addressed. But that's my feelings. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Yeah, Stephen, what are your thoughts on what Chris has said?
I think, I think Chris has nailed that there. I mean, what the Premier League has basically done is cherry-picked, you know, some of the best managers available. And that's just what they do. It's where the money is now, in the way that it was in Serie A in the 80s and the 90s. But the thing was then is that the predominant coaching nationality in Italy during those years were Italian coaches. Yes, you did bring in, you know, certain exceptions here and there, but, you know, the concept in the Premier League is to buy big, and managers are included in that. You only have to look at the fact that, I think what we're looking at, only a quarter of the Premier League going into this season is inhabited by English-born coaches. It's a hell of a low number. And it's only going to kind of like, it's not going to change much, really, especially as you're now looking at Championship clubs who are more and more looking to the continent for their coaches, who we have promoted this season. Wolverhampton Wanderers come back into the Premier League with a foreign coach. Fulham come back into the Premier League with a foreign coach. You know, so you're not even getting young up-and-coming managers, English, British managers from the division below, who are domestic. So it says everything that Eddie Howe seems to be the exception. Sean Dyche, you know, has done brilliantly with Burnley, but he's perhaps a functional manager that has more in common with the older generation of British managers who are dying off now. Sorry if that disrespects Sean Dyche and Burnley, which it clearly does. But, you know, there you go. For me, you know, he is another one that's come forth, and he does what he does very, very well. And but there's often no bows to it. There's no kind of like it's not well wrapped at times. It is what it is. Hands up, that's fine. I have no problem with functional football. You know, pragmatism is something that works on a sliding scale, which I've written about for the new magazine. And yeah, the Premier League does rely heavily on imports, and managers are just part of that.
It's funny, from my perspective, you're always going to have, unfortunately as well, the likes of Hodgson, Pardew, Pulis, Moyes.
You are.
And how much...
always going to be in... No, they're always going to be someone coming knocking on their door by November when a team is struggling. You know, you might find Huddersfield have a bad start. If they don't win in the first 10 and they dispense with David Wagner, they're going to turn to a David Moyes, or they're going to turn to, you know... There's somewhere where Sam Allardyce is going to reappear, because he will, you know, he will make a team fight. I can't argue with what these managers do. They are still students of the game, but they just read different books to what the other coaches read. They're effective, and they, you know, play the percentages, and they will keep a team in the Premier League. And they're the clubs you're looking at is the teams that do badly between now and October that will hit the eject button on their manager and bring in, you know, the meat and potato manager that will, you know, get them to 13th, 14th place and keep them in the Premier League for another handout of money for the following season.
So, I mean, in that respect then, really, a young English or a young British manager is always going to struggle with the likes of, you know, this top tier of managers like Guardiola and Mourinho and Klopp, etc. But then they're also up against this, like you've just said, that tried and tested, not archaic, but certainly different type of results-driven, anywhere fourth bottom upwards is seen as a result. You know, they've also got to combat those managers as well. They're almost third in line when it comes to club selecting managers, aren't they?
Well, they are. What you've got is you've basically got the top six clubs who are a division of their own. Manchester City, you know, in a division above that. So they're just off on another plane. Then you have the other five that make part of the top six. And then you've got other clubs that would like to kind of like, you know, emulate that. Your likes of Everton. You used to say teams like, you know, Aston Villa and Newcastle amongst that, but they drop out of the Premier League now. And you can't, you know, add teams like that. You know, the bottom half of the Premier League is easily interchangeable with the top half of the Championship. So you have a cluster of managers amongst that 20-team section that, you know, your Roy Hodgsons and your Sam Allardyces and your David Moyes and all of those style of managers can, you know, punch their weight with the likes of Marco Silva, with your likes of David Wagner, Claude Puel, you know, because they come into English football with great ideas, and but then they're working in clubs that only have a limited amount of time to be able to persevere with that, because if they feel threatened that relegation is going to be there, then they will push out, you know, a forward-thinking continental manager to bring in someone who's managed and played and coached within the English game for 30 years, for three decades, and can bring that experience and that savvy and that streetwise, you know, it's been there, seen it, and they've seen it go round and round in cycles. And football just repeats itself over and over again. The calendar will repeat itself. And the likes of Sam Allardyce, they operate on repetition of having seen everything happen before and spotting the patterns of what's happening again. And they can implement certain things and say, that happened there, it will happen again. And that's why they keep on not rising to the top, but rising to the middle again and again and again, like a cork. It'll just bob back up again, you know. And they are the hair in the drain, is what they are.
What a great quote.
I'll not sit on the fence. You know, they're awful for football, but they're effective.
You have stronger words than I was going to say. That's great. Right, Chris.
I'm only saying what I think you would have said there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You're right. You're absolutely right. Less expletives. You're absolutely right. Right, Chris. I'm gonna throw with what we've just said there. We've got a really good question from Aidan Williams at @Yad_Williams. And what we've just talked about continental managers, you know, good quality managers in the Championship, managers who've been there and done it. Aidan's got a question about Benitez, okay? And his question, quote, I'd be interested in thoughts on Benitez and the seemingly inexorable push towards constructive dismissal by Ashley, essentially trying to force him out, a complete refusal to invest and build on encouraging last season, offering Rafa to Spain, etc. What do you think?
I'm just glad I'm not a Newcastle fan, because after a promising season last year, you know, these same problems were floating around last season. Benitez flourished despite a lack of investment in the squad, and he's made some decent acquisitions this year, but unfortunately he's working under an owner who, quite frankly, doesn't care about the club. It's obvious that he wants to sell. He's been incredibly hard-nosed about the price that he wants for the club, despite his, well, some would say, blatant mismanagement of it for the past decade. You know, it's an unfortunate situation, but you know, from Ashley's perspective, he is a businessman. He is not a fan. He wants the best deal for his investment, and he doesn't care what fans think, and from his actions, doesn't care what his manager thinks either. Benitez is no fool either in this situation, because he knows that the fans are on his side. He has the weight of a decent season behind him. So the cards are stacked evenly here, and it's hard to see where the deadlock can be broken. What's for certain is that the club continues to suffer whilst this breakdown continues to exist. And it's a shame, really, because, you know, Newcastle, remember, are one of the few teams who have yet to spend over £20 million on a player. I think their highest transfer fee was £16 million for Michael Owen some 10 years ago or something like that. So it's, were this club to be run properly, given this, their location, given the fact that it's a one-team city, Newcastle should be there or thereabouts in terms of the arguably even the Champions League places, certainly the Europa League places. But just they've had a torrid few years under a chairman who is only intent on making himself richer, massaging his own ego. And if that comes at the expense of the club, then he's been quite happy to do that. It's a very sad state of affairs.
Do you, how How do you see that one? I mean, obviously we can't look into the future and predict the future, but how do you see the saga, if you like, at Newcastle? How do you see that ending?
It'll only end when actually gets an offer that he feels is acceptable. He's, you know, he can have as many protests on match day or whatever. You can have as many public announcements from Benitez, you know, criticising the lack of investment or backing. But the owner won't leave until he gets an offer that he feels is acceptable. You know, he has the club over a barrel to an extent. And, you know, he's proven in his actions over the past few years that any kind of dissent won't sway him in that regard. So that's the only way I see out of it, really.
Gary, what do you think, looking on from afar, you know, the troubles in Newcastle, do you see similar problems anywhere else, or do you think Newcastle is a one-off with regards to the owner, the manager, the situation?
I think Newcastle and Rafa Benitez are exactly the same as every other football club. Rafa Benitez is a manager who says, I'm two players short of a good team. I need to buy two players. Two players in inverted commas, could be three, could be four. But basically, the problem is that people who buy football clubs, and there are honourable exceptions, tend to buy football clubs with brass rather than silver in mind. They want to make money. They're not interested in silverware. Silverware is an end to a mean. It's means to an end. It's not an end itself. People who buy football clubs, businesses buy football clubs, do it to make money, not to win silverware. Silverware's fine, and if it brings more brass in the bank, but they'd swap £1 million extra in the bank for an FA Cup. Simple as. Now, I'm not saying that's nice. I'm just saying that's true. I think the problem is with Newcastle is, and Newcastle and it's Aston Villa and it's Sunderland and it's six or seven other clubs that would be deemed the big clubs in historical terms in this country, who are full on a hard time, shall we say. But there's only so many trophies to go around. And I do feel for Newcastle fans, and the passion in Newcastle for their club is immense. But I think Rafa Benitez is no mug, and he knows how to play the PR game, and that's exactly what he's doing. And, you know, if he could get Ashley to stump up, you know, £30 or £40 million to buy a couple of decent players, that would be great. I don't think it's going to happen. And I think probably Rafa will go before Ashley sells the club. Ashley wants a certain amount of money for that club. He's a businessman. Lots of people used to buy football clubs, and then as soon as they were successful businessmen, they made a lot of money, bought a football club, their brains went haywire, and they stopped thinking about business. The guy who bought Crystal Palace, I can't remember the guy's name actually, a while ago, he blew a fortune because he was a successful businessman, but blew it because he was a fan. Football clubs now are run as businesses. They're not run of clubs. It doesn't really matter what. And I think the problem is that so many football fans don't understand the realities. It's not nice. And, you know, I said there are honourable exceptions. The guy who owns Man City is not trying to make money out of it. And Roman Abramovich is not trying to make money out of it. But overwhelmingly, people who buy football clubs are interested in brass, not silver.
I do agree. I think Benitez will be gone before Ashley. I have absolutely no doubt about that. Right, we're gonna. I'm gonna. Stephen,
sorry,
you're...
Sorry.
Sorry.
Just before we move on, it's interesting. You know, whilst in the main, people who buy football clubs are in it to make money. Increasingly these days, we're seeing that football clubs are being used as a political tool. And Manchester City is an interesting example. Though their owners don't need to make money. They're already the richest people on the planet, but they're from a nation that needs the club to enhance its soft power and its image around the world. So, you know, is that more or less sinister than someone who's just boldly in it to enrich themselves? I'm not so sure, but that's another debate for another day.
that is a bombshell.
Great question.
It is. You're right. That's a whole podcast all by itself, that one. Right. We're gonna have to go to predictions at some point. So Stephen, obviously this isn't the end, but we've talked about the managers, we've talked about the business, we've talked about pre-season, we've talked about how teams are looking. For you, where do you see the Premier League title going?
Oh, you can't say anything other than Man City. You know, even down to the fact that they're being asked interesting questions this season, you know, still think they'll answer them. It's City, not by the margin they did last season, but I still see City winning.
Okay. Anyone pushing Klaus?
And any one of the cluster behind, I think. You know, if a team finishes within, you know, single figure points behind Manchester City, then it's a step forward for them. But it could be any of them. You know, hopefully Liverpool, you know, move on forward. But, you know, I think Arsenal are so much interested this season because, you know, Arsenal are under new management for the first time in over two decades. You know, can Tottenham continue to progress? Just what will Chelsea bring? And Manchester United under Mourinho, it's the third year of Mourinho, which is notoriously, you know, self-destruction time. But, you know, does he self-destruct the Manchester United having not delivered a league title? You know, we are now talking, 2019 at the end of this season. So by the end of this season, it'll be 6 years since Manchester United have won a title. You know, that's starting to stretch to an uncomfortable period of time for the team that has dominated, you know, since the mid-90s. So, yeah, you know, a lot of interesting questions, but potentially any of the other five that you would deem to be in the big six will be the one to chase them. But interesting for Arsenal, for me, is that they're not in the Champions League, and that could bring an interesting element for them.
Well, okay then. So, Chris, no pressure. What do you think in terms of Premier League title and who is going to push the eventual winners, Klaus?
I think it's still City's to lose. I think it was evident today from the way Guardiola was remonstrating on the sidelines for the Charity Shield that, you know, his team won't be being complacent this year. I'd agree with Stephen that Liverpool are arguably the closest challengers. I think the pressure is on Klopp this season. He's got to a few finals, but he still hasn't won anything. Mourinho, is there a method to his madness, or is he quite simply just going mad? this season, Arsenal is a massive unknown. How will the Emery regime play out? Tottenham are at risk of losing their momentum. No signings. You know, will Harry Kane stay beyond the season? How will the move back to the stadium affect them? It's a stadium full of questions, and at the minute, City are the only ones offering something like an answer. So for them, they're the ones to beat for me.
Gary, what do you think?
Very concise. City will win the title. Liverpool will be second, and the gap will probably be 7 or 8 points.
Wow. Okay. Well,
I'm expecting that to be Gary's Poland.
Gary, oh no!
God bless you, Steve. God bless you.
That's what I'm clinging to. I'm looking to look back on this at the end of the season, and we say that was Gary's poem.
as it'll be forever remembered. okay, due to your quickness and conciseness then, Gary, what do you think about the other end of the table? Who do you see?
Who goes down?
Who's going to struggle? Yeah.
Who goes down? Okay, there again, I'm going to be nice and concise. I'll keep things short. It will be Cardiff. I think Huddersfield will struggle, and I think Southampton will struggle as well. There you go.
I really do hope Cardiff go down, by the way. Chris, what do you think?
Oh, I do. On another day, I would love to get into this whole Neil Warnock beef with you, Stuart. I'm fascinated by that. But I'd agree with Gary. I think those three teams, the recruitment this summer has been poor. Their squads are arguably the weakest in the division. I'd imagine that all three of them will go down.
Stephen?
I'd go with Huddersfield and Cardiff there, but I'm going to throw Watford down instead.
Oh, that should please them.
Yeah, I just think I see a lot of Swansea in there. You know, they've changed managers on a revolving basis, and I think they'll do it again. And you can't keep changing the man in charge and not pay for it at some point. Sunderland did quite heavily. Swansea going down last season was, you know, the cause and effect of the relegation was a constant change of manager. I just think time will catch up on Watford.
I'll tell you what, if we were planning these links, it couldn't have worked out any better. I've got I've got a question or something for each, a topic for each of you to talk about. I know we've talked about the Premier League and it's a Premier League preview, but looking at the Championship, for me, there's three appointments in the Championship that I will keep an eye on, and I'm very interested to see how it pans out. So I've picked three managers that I'm going to ask you, each of you, about one of them and how you think they will do, mainly because they've come from completely different routes. They've arrived in the same division via completely different journeys. Gary, we'll start with you for obvious reasons. Frank Lampard at Derby.
I think Frank Lampard would do exceptionally well. And I think Steve Gerrard will do well with Rangers as well in Scotland. I know you didn't ask about that, but I think these are players who have got vast amounts of experience and successful, and they'll command respect from the players who are under their charge. I fancy Derby to get promoted this season under Lampard.
Okay. Do you think he's learned? I mean, obviously, he's played under some great managers. Do you think he's learned enough to be able to cope? I mean, the Championship is a brutal division.
The Championship is one of these leagues, and my wife's a Wolves fan, and hopefully we'll have time to come on to the Wolves later because I want to say something about the Wolves. But it's a league where everybody's competitive. You could be 7th or you could be 17th, and there's not much difference between every game the players there could go either way. It's a really competitive league. And I think what Frank Lampard has got, as well as playing under those managers, mixture of managers who are, with different sort of ways of looking at the game. But he's also one of these players who people will call, he's cerebral. He's got an A level or whatever. But I just think he's made to be a coach. And I think the same is true of Gerrard. And I think one of those two guys will be England manager in 10 years' time.
Well, that's not another Poland, is it? That's a proper prediction.
Okay. Now, one of my predictions is going to come true, and then we're going to stop talking about Poland.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Right, Chris, obviously you've mentioned him earlier, actually, and I wanted to talk to him because, obviously, through Ossesund and obviously playing Arsenal last season, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the tie at the Emirates, but Graham Potter, what do you think about him this season?
I think he's a very, very interesting coach and arguably has undergone the most unorthodox route to get to where he is today. He comes into a difficult job. Swansea have lost 13 players from last year. But the expectations will be that they saunter back up in the Premier League at the first time of asking. He has a rightly hyped reputation because of the job he did at Austin's. They got 3 promotions and a Swedish Cup. This is a guy who is academically smart. He's a master's degree. I think it's in emotional intelligence or something quite obscure like that. He studied science in university, but he's proven himself as a winner in Sweden. And interestingly, there was a recent interview there with The Guardian, and he basically admits that he'd given up on a coaching job in England. He didn't go to Sweden with the aim of eventually moving back to the UK because, he just understood it to be that route was closed off. Ostersund, you can't transpose one style onto another team in a completely different environment. I think he himself has acknowledged that. But what I would say, having watched Ostersund in their Europa League campaign last year, they were a well-drilled, talented attacking team who played Arsenal off the park at the Emirates. I watched that game and I was very impressed with how they were lined up and set up by the manager. I think Potter is an interesting individual. I think he's modest. I think he's engaging. And he's got off to a tremendous start with a 2-1 win at Bramall Lane yesterday. So I would be encouraged if I was a Swansea fan. They've had a few false dawns with the likes of Paul Clement in recent years, and Loudrup as well, who won a trophy before ultimately that went sour. But room to be cautiously optimistic in South Wales. I think they might have bagged themselves a promising coach indeed.
I agree. I know Graham, he used to work at Hull University. He's a great guy. Always, always thinking and talking about the game all the time. Stephen, last one then. Bielsa at Leeds United. Now, this is an appointment I had to look for numerous sources just to make sure it was actually true.
It's just too nuts to be true, isn't it? Given his reputation, given Leeds' reputation, it's imperfect, yet it's perfect. It's going to be spectacular. No matter how long it lasts, it's going to be spectacular. And they were brilliant today, from what I've seen of that game today against Stoke. They were brilliant. You know, really, really crisp passing the movement, great movement to players. I mean, and the story yesterday that I heard about him, he'd turned round and he'd asked one of the Leeds employees, you know, how long does the average Leeds fan have to work to be able to afford a ticket to go and watch Leeds? And the general consensus was like 3 or 4 hours. And he sent his players out to go and pick litter and to tidy up around the training ground for 3 or 4 hours as a lesson. That's how hard these people have to watch to come and work to watch you play. You know, to just try and I thought that was absolutely spectacular. I thought that was brilliant. It was just all too good. And I think it'll be boom or bust, whatever it happens. And see, Leeds are just such a complex football club. I mean, so many people are against them. But I have not a soft spot for them, but I have a great deal of respect for them because they've you know, played some magical football at times down the years. And I'd love to see them back in the top flight because they're a club that brings cat. It's like Nottingham Forest and you know, so many of these clubs that have fallen by the wayside that had such a, you know, an imprint on the English game.
Yeah, I must admit, it's that, you know, that Leeds United game. I can't wait. They come to Hull in October. I can't wait. Mainly to watch Leeds United. I'm a Hull City fan, but
yeah, that is going to be spectacular. Yeah,
can't wait.
Make sure you get a ticket for that one, Stu.
Without a doubt. Right, fellas. Yep. Before we go, then, I've got one more question for you. I need an answer and a sentence as to why. Okay, who are the team, or who are going to be the surprise package in the Premier League this season? Gary.
Who are you asking, Stu?
Yeah, you, Gary.
Okay. I think Wolves will be a surprise package this season. They've bought exceptionally well, and a star player will be Ruben Neves.
Okay. Chris, one team, surprise package, and one reason why.
Spurs, for all the wrong reasons. Lack of recruitment, lack of momentum. I think this will be a poor season.
Oh. Stephen?
Mm-hmm. Fulham, for all the reasons Chris mentioned earlier on.
Okay. All right. So that about wraps up this show, and all that's left for me to say is to say thank you to the computer contributors for this edition. So, Mr. Scragg, thank you very much, sir.
No problem.
Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Cheers.
Gary, thanks very much. I hope the move to Spain eventually happens and you get settled in next time we speak.
Let's just speak soon, mate.
No worries. And also, I hope your teams... I wish them all the luck in trying to catch Manchester City. Certainly for me, I don't have to worry about such trauma. You guys can deal with that trauma. I've just got to worry about staying in the Championship. So that's it. Finally, thanks for the listeners. Please be sure to join us again on the Lob Podcast. Thank you.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.